Hello and welcome to the Raw podcast brought to you by the Sunderland Echo. My name is Joe Nicholson and I'm joined by my fellow Sunderland writer at the Echo, Phil Smith. And we're going to be talking about the latest goings on at the club, the season as a whole, looking back at some of the highs and lows from the last 12 months or so. Phil, how are you doing this afternoon? We're recording this on a Friday afternoon with no game this weekend.
Yeah, looking forward to being back on the cricket field tomorrow, I have to say. Yeah. Disappointed not to have a playoff campaign. It's really strange, isn't it? We've got it's almost become the norm for Sunderland to be in the playoffs and for the season to sort of end, you know, positively or negatively on a really sort of exciting fashion. So I thought the last month of the season was quite tough for everyone, wasn't it? We're obviously fortunate that it's our job, but I think if you were a fan going to watch, it was pretty tough to take. I think, you know, nothing to play for. And the football not being great. So, yeah, I think like everyone kind of enjoying having a bit of a break from that, but also sort of anxious to see what comes next. It feels like there's a lot in limbo, doesn't it? And so, eagerly sort of anticipating some developments and hopefully some positivity for supporters and then going in and having a proper summer break. But I guess time will tell on that.
Well, hopefully there's no developments when you're playing cricket tomorrow afternoon. Hopefully Sunderland stay there.
It has been known to happen in the past, so I wouldn't be too surprised.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll come on to the head coach. Sunderland's season, of course, came to an end, losing 2-0 against Sheffield Wednesday last weekend. And the head coach situation now, it's a really important appointment, isn't it, Phil? Sunderland have had a bit of time now. They've appointed Mike Dodds until the end of the season to kind of assess their options and try and make the right appointment after making the wrong appointment with Michael Beale, and that didn't turn out well at all. And you reported this week that nothing is imminent at the minute. So can we read anything into that? Does that mean Sunderland are looking at people who are still in work, that their seasons haven't finished, or are they still assessing their options? Kind of what's your understanding of the situation?
Yeah, I think there's an element of both to that. I think the decision not to appoint somebody sort of straight after Michael Beale's departure was very much informed, I think, in part. Yeah, I suppose as a recognition of the fact that whatever, you know, the process in inverted commas had gone badly wrong last time. So therefore you need to kind of stop and assess that process, if you like. What was it that you got wrong? What do we need to change next time? And the other aspect of it is that I think one of the most difficult things they found when they were looking for Tony Mowbray's replacement was that they found it very, very difficult to get candidates in during the season. And I think most clubs generally would find that because, you know, it's just obvious, isn't it, that you're less likely to leave wherever you are at that stage of the season. And as we said repeatedly at the time, that was one of the reasons why the timing of when they got rid of Mowbray was completely wrong. Well, you know, whatever you thought of the actual decision, it was the timing that just didn't work out for anybody, really. So I think that's been a big part of the thinking, is that there'd be sort of a wider pool of candidates, if you like, in the summer. And I think that's probably the reason, by and large, why we haven't sort of had an immediate announcement at the end of the campaign, because I think that process is still running, if you like. As you said, I think it was on possibly Monday or maybe Tuesday that I reported at that stage, you know, nothing was imminent. Mm. That was sort of been my understanding since then. I personally kind of was expecting, you know, something more towards, you know, maybe towards the end of next week or the start of the week after. But the reality is, you know, obviously these things can change very, very quickly. And if you have a breakthrough or you reach an agreement, it can accelerate. So, you know, I haven't expected anything this week, but obviously that can change quickly. But I do think sort of the key thing has been that being patient, if felt, would lead to a better caliber of candidate. And maybe that means, you know, everyone will have to be a bit more patient. But it also raises the stakes, doesn't it? Because if you wait for such a long period to bring someone in, what it essentially did, if we're honest, was write off the previous season. It always seemed unlikely that Sunderland were going to get to the playoffs after that decision. So while I can understand why they did it, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, I do think it has made this appointment a lot more pressurised, if you like, and certainly raised the stakes. And it's one that clearly they have to get right.
Mm-hmm. I think even in the last few weeks, we've seen just how the picture can change by waiting until the end of the season. For example, Will Stiller's high profile, he's left Rons already, so, and he's someone that Sunderland looked at before, so now he's out of work. You've got Liam Rossini left Hull this week. I'm not saying that these people are going to get the Sunderland job, but already the pool of candidates that are out there out of work has changed from when Michael Beale left the club in February. But Now there's going to be a spell where kind of not a lot is really going on. There will be the announcement of the players that are going to be staying and leaving next season, but and then the squad will return around kind of June, July time for pre-season. But when can we kind of expect an appointment? When would be the ideal time to probably make an appointment? It's going to be before the players come back for pre-season, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose you could argue that there isn't a huge amount of time pressure at this stage. And as you mentioned, the players will now be gone until probably the back end of June, I think, sort of certainly mid to late June. So in theory, you know, there's not a huge sort of amount that bringing in the head coach sort of immediately actually offers you. The flip side of that is that what is happening at the moment sort of at the academy, like, is the summer recruitment planning is sort of underway. And the sooner you get a head coach appointment in, obviously, the sooner they can start feeding into that recruitment process, which is obviously the ideal scenario, because although obviously the club has a specific style that they recruit to, and the idea is that you have continuity no matter who the head coach is, at the end of the day, the head coach picks the team, don't they? So you want them to be involved in that process and to have an opinion. The sooner they're in, the sooner they can also give their own thoughts on what they want pre-season to be like. Again, that's in terms of the fixtures and the schedule, that's mostly being mapped out. But in terms of training and all those kind of things, you know, the new head coach will have their own ideas. So I don't think there's a sort of an urgent time pressure. And I don't think at this stage some of them are necessarily massively losing out by not having a new head coach in place. But I think realistically, you would like them to be in place over the next couple of weeks so that they can start to be involved in those recruitment meetings that are going to be happening at the academy. Like what we've had already is the initial recruitment meetings where I guess you'd call like a squad audit. So reflecting on how the season has gone, which positions you think you've got some issues, which positions you think you might be losing players. And obviously what begins to happen now is you take that to the obvious next step. You start talking about targets, who might be available, what your budget might be, who might fit in within that budget. My feeling is that it would be, even if the head coach isn't in charge of transfers, it would be really, really useful to have them involved in that process. So while I think I don't have a sort of panic or a stress, if you like, on the fact that there's no one through the door right now, I do think it's something that ideally you would like to happen this month, because although the players will be away and they won't be able to sort of be having that day-to-day contact with the players, I do think it would be a big, it would make the sort of recruitment a lot more seamless if they're in place. So we'll wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Well, as you mentioned there, decisions are already being made on players' futures. You reported this week that Corey Evans and Bradley Dack are set to leave the club at the end of their contracts. Sunderland had an option on both of those deals to extend it by an extra year. Also, there's Callum Stiles, who Sunderland signed on an initial loan deal with an option to make that deal permanent. We're still not sure what's going to happen with him. And then you've got Mason Burster going back to Chelsea following his loan spell. I suppose on those two, Evans and Dack, Phil, I think it seems pretty obvious that Sunderland weren't going to trigger that option for Dak's contract. I think he clearly hadn't played enough football in the year that he'd been at Sunderland. With Evans, I think over the last few months, it seemed kind of inevitable that he would probably leave at the end of his contract. But given Sunderland's lack of options in central midfield, I just think over the last kind of few weeks, with him coming back into the fold as well, you could have kind of made a case from giving him an extra year just because Sunderland don't have that natural holding midfield player. What do you kind of make of that decision to let him go?
Yeah, I can totally understand the decision because of how little football he's played over a period of time. And so it's always a gamble in terms of, can you be sure that they're going to, you know, be able to play a large number of games next season? But I was like you, by the end of the season, I kind of came to the point where I thought might be worth giving him another year. There's two reasons for that. One is that Sunderland have basically had like three windows since Corey Evans got injured, that ACL injury against Middlesbrough. And they've been really, really reluctant to bring in someone of his ilk. And in my opinion, I think it's really damaged the team. I think the balance of midfield hasn't quite been right all year. And the other factor, and so I guess I kind of like the idea of having Evans as an insurance policy, because in certain games where you need that kind of player, he will be there. And my fear is that if he goes and when he goes, which is what we expect to happen, then that player just won't be there and Sunderland won't have that option. And I think that was revealed in, there was more than one press conference that we sat in, wasn't there, Joe, after games, where Mike Dodds basically said, oh, well, I didn't really envisage giving Corey Evans that much time, or I wasn't planning to bring Corey Evans on. But the game situation kind of demanded his qualities. And I think that kind of tells you something. If you keep having to turn to someone, then it means they've got something to offer, doesn't it? So my view on it is a really clear one. I think that, you know, if they're going to go out and get somebody, then I've got no problems with the decision. If it's because they feel they don't need that player, then my fear is that will prove to be a mistake again next season. But listen, either way, I think Corey Evans has been a really fine sort of servant for Sunderland. I think that an absolutely integral player in that run under Alex Neil, if you think about that long and beaten run that finally got Sunderland out of League One. He also did something very, very sort of impressive, I always think. He totally won the crowd around. He wasn't always a crowd favourite, let's be honest, after coming from Blackburn. And to sort of show his experience and his maturity and his calm, sort of keep playing and to win everybody around, you know, all of us included, I think was really impressive. So I think he's been a fine player for Sunderland. While I don't have a problem with the decision in principle, I can see the sort of football and business case for it. I think if he's not replaced, I think he'll be a miss again next season. But I guess we'll wait and see. Maybe there has been a change of sort of stance behind the scenes. Maybe they do think they need someone of that player. And we'll see someone come in. The other interesting thing about both of them, again, I don't disagree with the decision on Dak either. But from what I'm thinking, I don't think it means there's a player over 30, does it, in the squad contracted for next season?
Nine
would be the oldest, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Which is incredible, really, isn't it? And why, like, you know, I absolutely have the view that, you know, experience doesn't necessarily mean age, it can mean appearances and what have you. I think that level of experience and maturity and sort of understanding the championship, understand the highs and lows of a season, managing that, I think that'll be a big miss in the dressing room. So while I don't disagree with either of the decisions per se, I am really, really hope that there's a bit of a recognition that balance needs to be redressed, if you like, and those players have to be recruited. I think some need another 10 as well. I don't know what you think, but I think Pritchard's been a big miss in the second half of the season. I think Ashish is very talented, and I think he's got a role to play, but he hasn't got Pritchard's consistency yet. Job obviously is an option to play that role if someone bring in a striker, but I think he's a very different type of player to a Pritchard or a Dak or an Ashish. I think it's probably a bit more dynamic, a bit more box-to-box. So yeah, no problem with the decisions, but I think both need replacing in terms of their attributes, if you like, and also their experience.
Yeah, I'd agree with having to bring in another number 10. I think the other thing with Evans, obviously you're recruiting from a playing side and non-playing ability, but his influence in the dressing room as well, a lot of the players you speak to, the younger players, a couple of weeks back we spoke to Harrison Jones, and one of the players who's done well in the 21 side, and he was saying how kind of big a kind of influence Evans has been kind of for the younger players and as the captain of the group. And I just think as well, positionally as well, we've seen this season that Dan Neil has had to play in that number six role in front of the back four because there's been no one else to do it. And I think a few of us kind of agree that Daniels would like to see him a bit further forward, kind of arriving in the box and being able to provide that goal threat, but he's just not been allowed to do that because Sunderland have not had that holding midfield. So I agree. I think if you let Evans go, you've got to bring in somebody else who can play in that number six role and kind of give Sunderland a different option. But what do you think about Styles? He's someone that's come in. He's played predominantly as a left back. For Barnsley, he's played more of a central midfielder, but we haven't really seen him in that role apart from really the final day of the season against Sheffield Wednesday when he got substituted at half time. So what do you think about his situation?
Yeah, honestly got no idea which way that's going to go. Do I think from what we've seen on the pitch over the last few months, do I think someone would go and trigger the deal? I think probably not. However, I think we have to put it into context. I don't think he'd ever really played left back before. He'd obviously played left wing back quite a lot, but you know, that defensive side of the game. So that was a very, very difficult situation for him to come into. He'd obviously had surgery on his appendix before he'd come into the club, so he was still finding his feet after that. So I think to come into a team that, if we're brutally honest, was unravelling off the back of an injury, out of position, I think you've got to put those performances into context. I also think he looked a lot more solid when he went to wing-back. I thought he looked like a player with something to offer. The other aspect of it is that, you know, Sunderland, from my understanding, have been tracking him over quite a few transfer windows. So they obviously, you know, it wasn't just like a stopgap signing. Obviously, they had some issues on the left of defence with Elise and Serkin, and that's partially why they signed him. But they obviously feel he's got the attributes to be part of the team going forward. So I don't think it's quite as clear-cut as you might otherwise think it would be, given that he probably hasn't had a huge impact on the team. from my understanding, the option can be triggered. It's basically got a few kind of good few weeks to run yet. So my assumption is probably that hopefully the head coach might be able to sort of have some feedback into that process. If you bring in someone in who's never going to play with the back three, does that mean that, you know, it's difficult for Stars to bring into the team? You know, maybe it does, and therefore maybe you say, actually, it's probably not worth the investment. If you bring in someone who is going to play with the back three, then you might think, oh, what a great sort of player in terms of he can fill three or four positions in that system. So I genuinely think it's too early to say on that one. I'm not sure which way it will go. And if all goes well in terms of getting a head coach in over the next couple of weeks, then maybe they'll be able to sort of feed into that process, and that might sort of have an impact either way.
Mm-hmm. Just finally, before we come on to our highs and lows of the season, our kind of season review, just it was announced this week that Sunderland have appointed David Bruce as the chief business officer at the club. Bruce has been at the club since last year, kind of stepping up roles now. So just on that, Phil, kind of what will that mean in terms of his involvement with the club away from the pitch?
Well, I suppose it doesn't make a huge difference, and that he's obviously been working as chief brand and commercial officer since he came in earlier in the season. So the only real difference it makes is his responsibilities are greater, because obviously he'll be taking on a large amount of what has been Steve Davison's workload for the last couple of years. I think we've already kind of seen what Sunderland want from David Bruce, both in his previous role and moving forward. Obviously, the announcement that Hummel are taking over the kits, and that Fanatics are going to be running a sort of rebuilt club store and a new online store. You can see, and it was actually referenced in the accounts last week, that they feel that commercially the club isn't getting the kind of revenues that they feel they can because of the fan base. And I think it's also fair to say the fan base have been really disappointed with the sort of retail and ticketing and customer service offering that's been in place for the last few years. So I think basically we will see a lot more of what we've seen around sort of the improved kit offer. And I think that's where Bruce's, you know, a lot of his work is going to be done in trying to increase that revenue, if you like. And I imagine that obviously there's a lot of investment going into the Stadium of Light at the moment to try and refresh that sort of, I think it's coming up 20, 25 years, isn't it, since that opened. So I think we'll see more on that front over the next year or so. So yeah, I suppose day to day it won't change a huge amount, but what we're definitely going to see is we're going to see a big push, I think, for Sunderland to try drive those commercial revenues, because obviously they're pushing to be sustainable against teams and compete with teams in parachute payments. We know that one way they feel they can bridge that gap is either by developing young players and to play them in the team or to sell them on. And obviously they see the commercial side of the club is an absolutely vital part of building that income, if you like. And that's going to be, I think, what David Bruce's kind of key task is going to be. And yeah, the kit announcements and what have you that we've already had, I think, are sort of the start of that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to come on to now our season review. We sent a tweet out earlier this week asking fans for some of their highs, lows, goal of the season, player of the season. So we're going to go through ours. Now, we'll start with the highlights of the season, which probably comes from the first half of the season for many fans. I think the obvious one and the one we had most in the comments was the 5-0 win over Southampton, Phil. Seems like a different season ago, really. Like, so much has happened since that day back in September, at the start of September. It was right after the transfer window closed. There was this kind of questions, are Sunderland going to sign another striker? Are players going to go? And then they went and thumped Southampton 5-0, a team that have just come down from the Premier League. So I say that was probably my highlight. Would you share that view? And are there any other highlights that stick out from the campaign?
Yeah, I had to think long and hard about this one, which told its own kind of story. As you said, the Southampton game, it just feels so long ago. But I think that was definitely my highlight. There was a few factors to it. One was that, you know, the season had actually started really disappointingly, in that Sunderland were playing okay, but obviously had those two really bad defeats, didn't they, against Ipswich and Preston, even though I didn't think they played that badly, knocked out of the Carabao Cup. And it all felt, because of the uncertainty that had been around Tony Mowbray's future over the summer, it all felt very unsettled, didn't it? As you say, and then very difficult end to the window, where there was a huge amount of speculation about Jack Clarke, Patrick Roberts. I think even Dan Neil was being linked with a move away at one stage, wasn't he, on deadline day?
Yeah, Ekwa, I think.
And so for Sunderland to go out, Yeah, Ekpo as well. That's right. So for and Sunderland to go out the next game and play that well against, you know, a team that had been in the Premier League the previous season, it almost felt as if Sunderland had kind of drawn a line under a very, very difficult few months. And it felt like, okay, we're kind of back on an even keel and we can kick on now. That's obviously absolutely not what happened, and it proved to be a bit of a false dawn. But I think it's a bit of a reminder, to be honest, that for most of the first half of the season, like, Sunderland weren't a bad team. They played decent football. They were very, very, very competitive. They just, this was one of the few days where they were able to take their chances consistently. So, to be honest, I by and large enjoyed the first half of the season. It was very frustrating at times, obviously, with the striker issue and some are not always getting what their performances deserve. But the first half of the season, I thought in the main was okay. And obviously the Southampton game, you know, that brilliant fifth goal with Bennett doing about three twists and turns and Chris Riggs scoring. Yeah, I think that was definitely the highlight of the season. And like I say, just a real shame that actually it proved to be a false dawn, really, rather than more of a turning point.
I was just having a look back at the highlights from that game before, and there was, I remember in the first minute, I think it was Sirkin giving the ball away. Sunderland had conceded a corner, and then from the corner, Sunderland broke, and then Hume crossed the ball for Clark, and then he headed it in, and then within a few minutes later, Ekwa had made it 2-0. It was just one of those days where everything went right for Sunderland. The other one I had written down as a highlight was the 1-0 win over Leeds in December, when Mike Dodds took charge. I thought it was two massive clubs playing. It was a night game, wasn't it? And then Bellingham getting that goal. Yeah. I think it was just a big occasion. They obviously came with a big backing as well. And that was another game that stood out, backing up that win over West Brom when Mike Dodds was in charge. So
yeah,
they were probably the two for me that stood out.
Yeah, I think so. That's a really good shout, the Leeds game. So I think off the back of the West Brom one, obviously it gave us the feeling that actually there was a bit of continuity there in terms of, yes, Tony Mowbray had gone, but this was still a talented squad. You know, hopefully it won't be too much of an impact. Obviously, they then made some bad decisions off the back of that. But yeah, that's a really good shout. I think especially that Leeds game and that Joke goal, it did feel like things were, you know, maybe things will still go in the right direction. But yeah, unfortunately, then all, I think the next home game after Leeds would have been Coventry at home, wouldn't it? Which leads us, I guess, into our low lights, really, because that was sort of the beginning of the end of the season, really, wasn't it? You know, a lot of fan disappointment and anger in the stadium. Now Huggins' injury, which would be right up there for a low light of the season for me, given how brilliant he'd been through the first half of the campaign and what a good story that had been. And although there were the odd really good results under Michael Beale, I'm thinking specifically Hull away at Boxing Day was obviously a good win. You know, nothing was ever really the same this season after that Coventry game. It felt like a huge turning point in the season, you know, the manner of the defeat and also the way things seem to be unraveling.
Yeah, we'll come on to lowlights there. You mentioned a few there. You could also throw in the Blackburn game, the 5-1, but I think probably the biggest lowlight and biggest frustration will come around that kind of December, January time where the season did kind of all unravel. I remember we were travelling down to Bristol City in that kind of evening. We were travelling down on the Friday night and it was Dodds' last game in his first spell of interim boss, and the news came out that Beale was going to get the job. There was then also the ticketing stuff about the derby, and then just the way the season unraveled. I think that was kind of, for me, the biggest kind of low light and frustration is just how quickly it did unravel after those two impressive wins against, as we mentioned, Leeds and West Brom. And then when Michael Beale came in, there was a big backlash. There was the reaction, and clearly a lot of fans were very underwhelmed by the appointment. And we said at the time that the derby game could either make or break him. If he went and won that derby, somehow won that game against Newcastle in the FA Cup, then that would get him a lot of credit in the bank, whereas actually it worked the other way. And that almost kind of put the nail in the coffin almost, because as you mentioned, that whole game, they'd actually had a few decent results after the Coventry game, which was obviously, there was a backlash in the stadium at Light. They got a win over Hull. They got a win over Preston, didn't they, on New Year's Day? And I think they were kind of building a little bit of momentum. And then the derby game came at a bad time, and then it was the game against Hull on the Friday night where the fans were chanting against Beale, and that's where you thought there's no way back for him from there, was there?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I wrote down my low light was the Newcastle game, and it was just everything around that was just felt completely wrong. And I think it was a huge turning point for a lot of supporters in terms of, really damaged how they felt about the ownership, I think, with what happened with Black Cats Bar. I think, obviously, we've been through a period where Sunderland generally had been progressing, I think, under the current ownership. And although there were a lot of debates and a lot of frustrations at certain times within that, you know, not signing strikers on deadline day, all these kinds of things, I think generally there is a sense of progress. And I think the appointment of Beale and things starting to go wrong, and then the Derby game, I think, undid a lot of that, from which I still don't think Sunderland recovered at all. And I thought Sunderland on the pitch that day were a mirror of Sunderland off the pitch. Obviously, we knew that the most likely result was for Newcastle to win. It was obvious that they were probably going to win that game because of the golf in quality. But I just thought Sunderland's approach was so meek that they almost made it inevitable. And although you expected Newcastle to go on and win the game, however Sunderland settled, it was just such a disappointing performance. And I think when you actually saw, you know, Blackburn, for example, in the next round, gave it a real good go, didn't they, and nearly got a result, I think that just underlined how on and off the pitch, you know, Sunderland's approach had been all wrong. And I did sympathise with Beale, like what you said, in that, you know, it wasn't his fault he was an underwhelming candidate, and it wasn't his fault that the club made such a mess of the Derby arrangements, which clearly, you know, helped sort of damage the mood, and that impacted him. But I do think my overall biggest frustration from the season is the way that Sunderland went from one of the most enjoyable teams in the country to watch to what we saw at the end of the season, where, to be honest, it was pretty painful viewing at times. Even when Sunderland lost games for a long period of time, I came away feeling as if I'd enjoyed watching what they were doing and felt really good about it. And the reality is that, you know, the appointment of Michael Beale was the moment at which pretty much they stopped being that vibrant, front foot, fearless team that we loved watching. And that's something which has just accelerated since. So that's probably my biggest frustration, really. It's so long we'd wanted this young, vibrant, front foot Sunderland team, finally got it, and then almost just kind of totally self-inflicted, moved away from it. That's something which still really, really, really frustrates me in the season. And for me, it's like the biggest thing I want to see change this summer. I want that Sunderland back, because, you know, you can accept the odd defeat, you know, if you sort of feel as if you're moving in the right direction. And with the players in the squad, I don't think there's any reason why it shouldn't be that, you know, shouldn't be good to watch.
Yeah, I think just as well, one of the biggest disappointments for me was just the way it kind of ended for Tony Mowbray. I think just speak for you as well, kind of just one of the kind of nicest guys, had time for everybody, obviously did a great job last season, incredible job last season, really, to get Sunderland into the playoffs. And of course, he's had to step away now from Birmingham. We still wish him well and pass on our thoughts, but just the way it kind of ended for him. And as we've said before, like Sunderland, they weren't in incredible form when Mowbray left. I think it was 2 wins in 9, but just the way that they went from a team that was very dynamic on the front foot and then the season just unraveled so quickly was a big disappointment for a lot of fans and us covering the team. But we'll move on to goal of the season. I had to look back at a few of these. Conveniently, the club put out a video just before about an hour before we came on of all the goals this season. So I was having a look back at some of those. The one that got mentioned quite a lot on our post on social media was Niall Huggins' goal against Watford, where he beat a couple of players and then hit one into the top corner. I think that was his first goal in senior football as well. And as you mentioned before, a big disappointment for him to get injured in that Coventry game and now be out for a long time. But just kind of the emotion he showed as well. We spoke to him after the game as well, and he was saying how tough it had been to come back from the injury that he's had, which makes the injury he's got now is kind of very disappointing as well for him. So that was one that stood out. I don't know if you had any others that kind of stood out for you this season.
No, I mean, that was the obvious one for me. The other one that I thought was just an unbelievable goal was Jack Clark's Ipswich, where I think, was it a corner that sort of broke to him on the... And I still don't really understand how he managed to strike it that cleanly.
Yeah.
And the reason I picked out that goal was at the time, you know, the best goals are always the ones that are just so unexpected. And when the ball came to Clark, they just didn't see how he was going to score that quickly, how he was going to get to that part of the goal. I don't even remember the goalkeeper moving. It all happened in such a flash. It's hard to say that's your goal of the season, because at the end of the season, and lost the game. But I remember thinking that strike was just absolutely unbelievable. So in terms of the actual quality of goal, I think that one would be up there. Jobes at Southampton.
Was
an amazing goal, the one that he placed in the far corner. Again, you're sort of biased against that one because at the end of the day, it didn't end up in a win. So that's why I think I would give it to Huggins. But those were the two strikes that I remember at the time sort of my jaw actually dropped, because you just didn't expect them to score from there. So yeah, those are the two that sprung to mind as well.
Yeah, the Job one, at the time when he went in, obviously suddenly come back from 2-0 down, and you're thinking this could be a really special away day against a side that were fighting for promotion. If someone had gone on to win, for example, unfortunately they did go and lose it 4-2. The other one I had written down was Pritchard's goal against Preston on New Year's Day, where he kind of cut across the ball and it kind of swerved away from the goalkeeper. That was the other one I had in terms of just a strike. The other one was Dan Neil against Norwich, where I think Jack Clark beat a couple of players and then slipped it through to Neil, who then beat the goalkeeper. I think Roosen had, his movement had kind of created some space in between. So that was a good one as well.
Is that a little chip? Yeah.
That was the West Brom one. That was the other one I had.
Was it?
That made it 2-0. Yeah, where we went through and he chipped the goalkeeper. So a few good goals, but most of them from the first half of the season we have more fond memories of. We'll come on to player of the season. I think it's going to be pretty obvious in most people's eyes that it's going to be Jack Clark.
Definitely. I think, I don't think you can say otherwise, really, when you just look at his goal output. And I think the other thing about Clark is, like, it's not as if he just picked up where he left off. Actually, there was a huge improvement. Like, last season, he was a really good player for Sunderland. But I don't think we were looking, coming into the season, going, this is the guy who's going to carry Sunderland's attack. I think last season, it had mostly been about Ahmad, hadn't it? And even Roberts to an extent. Again, that's not saying Clark hadn't been very good. He'd been excellent. He'd scored some really important goals. But I think the way he took on that burden from Ahmad and became pretty much the best player in the Championship. Obviously, he had Somerville, who plays in his position for Leeds, who won the award, in Smodic. But I think Clark, up until his injury, was right up there. And I think that was an incredible achievement. So for me, I don't think there's really much of a debate. I think it has to be Clark. I think you could pick out a few other players who I think took a big step forward this season and deserve credit for their consistency in a difficult season. And I would say Dan Neil, Trey Hume and Dan Ballard, I would all put in the same category of it had a pretty solid previous season and had shown they could play at the level. I think they really stepped up and became leaders despite their age, which I think is really to their credit. And I think for the most part, they all performed at a really consistent level. So I think they all deserve sort of a mention and some credit. But yeah, Clark's the clear player of the season. And for young player of the season, I would probably say Dan Neil, but I would definitely put Trey Hume in that category, because I think sometimes it's easy to forget that it's only 18 months ago that he barely played a game for Sunderland. You know, and again, the fact that he's performing so consistently now, and I think also the fact that he's played 55 games, including internationals this season. Actually, I haven't seen much of a drop-off from him recently, and I think that's really creditable. And I think Job would have to go into that conversation as well. I think to get seven goals in pretty much his first season, I think that's really impressive as well. I do think, although there aren't loads of candidates, I do think there are a few players who have sort of deserved some credit for their consistency in a really difficult season.
Yeah, as you say, I think the way Clark has stepped up and kind of at the start of the season was almost replacing those goals that Ahmad had scored as well, kind of single-handedly as well. Whereas last year you had Clark, you had Roberts, was in better form, you had Ahmad as well. You kind of had three of them kind of chipping in, whereas at the start of the season, a lot of it was going through Clark. And it was a shame he did pick up that ankle injury and then didn't quite rediscover that form that he had in the start of the season, towards the end of the season. But by that stage, Sunderland's season was fizzing out. And as you mentioned, I think Dan Neil, I think, deserves a big mention as well. I think that's a position, going back to kind of Corey Evans playing that whole midfield role, I think if anything had happened to Dan Neil midway through the season, I think Sunderland would have been in real trouble, because there was not a natural replacement to come into that holding midfield role. And as I said before, I think I'd like to see him play further forward as that player that can arrive late in the box and maybe get up to 10 goals a season and chip in more. But I think the way that he adapted and played in that holding midfield role and was disciplined enough to play there was huge for Sunderland. And if he had picked up the injury that he had towards the end of the season, if that had happened in December, I think Sunderland would have been in real trouble, because I think there was not a natural replacement to come into that position. So big credit to him. And as you mentioned, Trey Hume as well, and a very good season from him. I think up until, was it the Watford game where he didn't play? I think he was the only outfield player that had started every game. So, and I remember speaking to him a couple of times and asking him, like, is there going to be a time where you're going to get taken out the side just because they track their numbers and their minutes so closely now? And he was just saying, like, why would I come out the side? I love playing. I love, you know, competing for Sunderland, and just wouldn't want that rest, even though he's playing every week for Sunderland, every week for Northern Ireland. I think it was credit to him that his standards didn't really drop significantly towards the end of the season. So, yeah, put him in that category as well. The next one we've got, because we've kind of covered young player of the season there, player you want to see more of next season?
Yeah, the one I put down was Dennis Serkin. I think it's obviously a very obvious one, but I think that one of the, obviously the two positions we spoke most about being a problem for Sunderland this season were, as you mentioned, holding midfield and strikers. They were the two obvious ones. But I do think left back has been a massive issue all season. So for much of the season, you know, Sunderland have either had to put one of their right backs at left back, and Trey Hume was fine whenever he was there. He was very good, in fact, but clearly he's better at right back. Or as we've seen recently, they've had to put a player there who would probably rather play in a different position but can do it. So Yelder and Stiles are the two obvious ones. Yelder, who I think I told you, had me after he signed, that he was a centre-back first. Stiles, who's obviously a midfielder or a wing-back rather than a left-back. I do feel like that was a massive issue for Sunderland all season. I think it took away sort of in attack and in defence. I thought Elise, when he first came back, which was around the sort of Preston game, the Newcastle game, I thought he was one of Sunderland's best players. I think he's made a solid comeback recently, and so that gives me a lot of optimism for next season. I think Serkin, there's two aspects to it. One, he's a very good defender, and two, I think he is excellent in terms of getting forward and supporting Jack Clark. He overlaps him. He makes it really hard for the defenders to sort of double up on Clark, because Serkin obviously gives that option to either go outside or inside. I just think he's such a huge talent. I think he's been such a massive miss for Sunderland this season. And I think if he can get fit in pre-season and stay fit, I think what has been one of Sunderland's weakest positions this season becomes one of their absolute strongest positions without having to spend a penny. So, yeah, for me, if there was one kind of player I could push a button and say you're going to get sort of 40 games out of him next year, for me, it would be Serkin, because I think that if him and Elise stay fit, then I think that's going to be, I wouldn't go as far as to say transformative, but I think that's going to make a massive impact on Sunderland.
Yeah, I'd add Elise written down, and kind of going back to the biggest disappointments, obviously, and frustrations. I think the head coach is obviously the biggest one, but you mentioned Niall Huggins' injury. I think Dennis Serkin's injury as well. I think he actually started the season well. I think the first few games, he was one of Sunderland's better players, and then he picked up an injury, and then there was another injury setback when he came back, and it was just a shame to not have him, because he would have been such a big boost. And to not have him and Elise there, it did really take away from that centre-back position. And Elise as well, a player who had his injury setback last season and then had surgery in the summer and then came back in January and had another setback. And as you say, when he came back towards the end of the season, he looked like he gave Sunderland a lot, whether he was playing as a left-back, whether he was playing on the left of a three like he did at Watford. I think he looked very comfortable there and gave Sunderland that natural left-footed option. So I'd like to see a lot more of him next season. He signed a new contract as well, Elise, this season, I think until about 2027. So a player who's in it for the long term, and two young players there that if they can stay fit, Sunderland have got two excellent players there on their hands in kind of the same position as well. Maybe Elise could even move into a centre-back position as that left-footed centre-back. He brings a lot of options there. The other one I had written down as played, maybe want to see more of, and you could kind of put him in the young player of the season category from the second half of the season, is Chris Rigg, and still quite hard to believe that he's still only 16, the way that he played in the second half of the season, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was exceptional, really. And I think we reached the point, didn't we, by the end of the season where he was in the team on merit. I think, obviously, the big question is whether he decides to sort of stay and sign a pro deal next month. We obviously still don't know which way that's going to go. You'd be very hopeful he's going to stay. We know he loves it here. And Sunderland have kind of shown that they're willing to give him opportunities. I think you can look at Job this year and see that there's potentially the chance for him to be a regular starter next year in his first sort of full season, if you like. And I suppose the interesting question then becomes, you know, does he stay out wide or does he move into the middle? He's obviously going to be a centre midfielder in the long run. You know, as Mike Dodds has explained, it's something that's very common with young centre midfielders to start them out wide where there's a bit more time and space and there's a little bit less pressure. So if he does stay, which hopefully he will, I do think he'll be a regular next season or relatively regular next season. And what's going to be interesting is how quickly he matures and develops and does Sunderland move him in field. potentially, you know, going somewhere to address some of the issues we've talked about earlier in the podcast, or does he kind of stay out there and compete with Barr and Roberts? And yeah, I think he's potentially a player with a big part to play next season. What we're hoping is that Sunderland are going to get back to this front foot aggressive style, and I think Riggs' energy certainly is pressing. You know, I think there's definitely a chance he plays regularly, so that would be something really exciting to see. And like I say, we've all got a long wish list for the summer, haven't we, in terms of things we'd like to see. Mm-hmm. But I imagine for a lot of supporters, you know, seeing the picture of Riggs signing a pro contract would be right up there, and that's testament to how well he did.
Mm. It'll be interesting to see where he does fit in, because in pre-season, like last summer, he was kind of played in that number 10 position, wasn't he, in Sunderland's tour of America. And then in the last few weeks, he's been playing on this right-hand side ahead of Patrick Roberts as well, who hopefully with a good pre-season can get back to kind of the levels that he showed last season. But it'll be interesting to see how Rigg fits in. Still not kind of sure where his best position will be, which is just understandable when he's only 16. I suppose similar with Joe Bellingham as well. Still not quite sure where he's going to fit in. Is he going to be a box-to-box midfielder? Is he going to be a 10? Is he going to be a striker? There's a lot of the younger players where you're not quite sure where they're going to fit in, and it's going to be interesting to see how they do develop, how much game time they get. And I think one thing is we still have to be patient with these players as well. We've seen that it is natural when you're that young, you're going to have dips in form. It happened to Dan Neil a couple of seasons ago that there will be times where maybe if they're overplayed or kind of hectic schedules in the Championship where they will have dips in form, but it doesn't mean they're a bad player and doesn't mean that they can't come back. So I think that's something to remember next season as well. But we'll come on to the last category that we had, which is overall mark out of 10. Now, quite difficult considering, as we've mentioned, the first half of the season was so promising and then it tailed off quite dramatically in the second half of the season. But Sunderland finished 16th in the Championship. Still easy to forget that it's still only their second season back following that promotion from League One. And I think if they hadn't have finished 6th last year and got in the playoffs, would we view this quite differently? Because 16th does seem quite underwhelming, but it is easy to forget that the club have, you know, it's only their second season back in the Championship, but equally the aim at the start of the season, I think Christian Speakman said it, was to get in the playoffs again, and they've fallen well short of that.
Yeah, I think to be honest, at the start of the season, if you'd said 16th, I would have been bitterly disappointed. You know, and you're right in terms of the context and in terms of the division, the fact that it was still only their second, they had overachieved the previous year. But I still think 16th would have been seen as a big step backwards. So I've ended up going with 4 out of 10 because I marked the first half as probably about a 7. And then the second half, I think you could go as low as a 2. Not just because of the results, but because the football has been so bad to watch. And I think that's been so disappointing, certainly over the last sort of 6 weeks or so. And I think the fact is that as well, it's not just been the results and the style of play and stuff. I think it stopped being fun following Sunderland for everyone because of what happened with Michael Beale, what happened with the derby. It just became, I think Sunderland had worked so hard and done so well to sort of shake off this image they had of, you know, being a bit of a basket case, you know, impossible to manage, always some drama. And although it means there's always something to write about for us, I actually think it made the whole experience a lot less fun than it had been the previous year. So I think the second half of the season for me is like a 2 at most, really. So I've kind of gone somewhere in the middle because, as you say, and as we've talked about a lot on this podcast, there was some good football playing, some good positives in the first half of the season. So I'll end up with a 4 and very much a must do better next time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd probably agree with the 4. I think, as you said, the football at the start of the season where Sunderland were, there was still that excitement kind of carried over from last season under Mowbray, the fact that they'd been in the playoffs the last season and it felt like they could be a challenge, they could challenge again. And I think based on the kind of squad, you look at it, was Sunderland that far off kind of West Brom, Norwich towards that 5th, 6th spot? I don't think so. If they had kind of a natural goal scorer, a reliable goal scorer, I think that would kind of be the realistically where they should be finishing, around those kind of competing for the playoff spots. But the way that they did fall away in the second half of the season was extremely disappointing. But Phil, that kind of brings us to the end of today's podcast. Best of luck tomorrow with your cricket match. What's the weather looking like for tomorrow?
Yeah, glorious. Oh, good. Should be good. And then hopefully we'll be back next week with some more significant sort of updates. I think that's what we're all hoping for. Maybe we can do some special podcasts on retained lists and new head coaches and all that stuff next week. But we'll see. You never know with something.
Yeah, there's still certainly plenty of stuff for us to write about with the head coach, with players. So even though Sunderland aren't playing over the next few weeks, there's still going to be a lot going on. And you can find all of the latest news over on the SAFC section of the Sunderland Echo website. And as Phil said, we will be still be recording regular Raw podcasts. So keep an eye out for those. So once again, thanks a lot for listening to the Raw podcast.